So what did we do last week? We looked at ratcheted key exchange. We were working on the definition for ratcheted key exchange for 2 weeks already, and our aim was to understand how the definition really works. So and we focused on unidirectional ratcheted key exchange, which is the notion in which the sender will always send and the receiver will always receive. And the primary thing that we did last week was identifying the trivial winning conditions, the trivial attack, and the concepts of how to prevent these attacks. The second step that we did last week is to come up, or was to come up with a construction. And the third step was to at least intuitively think about how we could prove security for this. And so we had somewhat a high-level security argument. What we are going to do today is that we will extend this security argument and come up with a formal proof. And then, and this was part of the exercise for this week already that we discussed in the exercise session just before, is that randomness or weak randomness is indeed a realistic threat. And we will look at how to prevent or how to strengthen constructions against that threat. So weak randomness is the threat, and we will then look at how we can build a building block, a primitive that we call key updatable key encapsulation mechanisms. And with this building block, key updatable key encapsulation mechanisms, we will be able to protect a ratcheted key exchange construction against weak randomness. Okay, without losing any further time, we will quickly look again at what type of construction of ratcheted key exchange we are looking at right now and what our arguments were that this construction is indeed secure. So our construction consists of three algorithms, and these three algorithms are an initialization, a send algorithm, and a receive algorithm. And the two main building blocks that we use that we can instantiate are a key encapsulation mechanism. And during initialization, we generate an initial key encapsulation mechanism key pair, public key and secret key, encapsulation key and decapsulation key. And we also generate a signing key pair, signing key and verification key. And so the basic idea is that we give the encapsulation key to the sender, the decapsulation key to the receiver, the signing key to the sender, and the verification key to the receiver. Because basically what the sender will always do is try to encapsulate a symmetric key to the receiver. And so the sender needs the encapsulation key, receiver needs the decapsulation key. And in order to protect against active adversaries, the sender will use the signing mechanism to sign the ciphertext. And so the sender needs the signing key and the receiver will need the verification key. The basic process for sending something is that the sender will first encapsulate something to the receiver, just as I said, then protect the ciphertext with a signature. And the interesting part here is that we want to update the key pair for two reasons. First of all, we have the security guarantee forward secrecy that we want to achieve. And then secondly, we have that guarantee that once something malicious happens on the wire between sender and receiver, we want that the sender and receiver are out of sync, that they diverge, that their key material becomes independent. And so for that reason, we have basically an update mechanism that takes the current public key, takes some secret information, and comes up with a new public key. And this update mechanism is based on the random oracle model, or on the random oracle. In the random oracle model, we basically idealize hash functions. So we talked about the random oracle model last week. The basic idea is that we idealize a hash function, and the guarantees that we hope to obtain from a hash function is that every output of the hash function looks random, and we obtain no information about the output of a hash function until we invoke the hash function, until we take the hash function, put the inputs into the hash function, and see what the output is. As long as we did not do that, we have no information about how the output of the hash function looks like. And that in particular means that the description of a hash function will not help us to gain any information about the hash function unless we use that description to invoke the hash function. So on the receiver side, of course, what the receiver first does is verifying the signature, then decapsulating the ciphertext, obtaining the key, and then also updating the decapsulation key, the secret key, with the hash function. This is on a very, very high level. The actual construction looks a little bit more difficult, so we will look at the construction briefly. This was the construction from last week. So, init algorithm, I just explained that. We generate key pairs, chem key pair, signing key pair, and distribute the information in the state of the sender and the receiver. Send operation first encapsulates a key, then signs the current ciphertext, generates a fresh signing key and a fresh verification key. The verification key is attached to the ciphertext and also signed. So basically we have a signing chain of signature key pairs. And then we use the random oracle, the hash function here, based on the inputs of the ciphertext and a transcript variable and the secret symmetric key that is encapsulated with the chem. The output is then the actual output key. Just as a reminder, this key is used outside of the ratcheted key exchange mechanism, for example, to encrypt messages on the messaging channel. Then we obtain a new transcript variable. And finally, we obtain the next decapsulation key that we use to generate our encapsulation key. The sender forgets about the decapsulation key and only stores the encapsulation key, also stores the new signing key and the transcript. And the receiver basically does the same, except for not generating the encapsulation key from the decapsulation key, but just store the decapsulation key. And reversing the encapsulation with the decapsulation, reversing the signature with verifying the signature. This was the basic principle. And so the idea for how to prove security of this scheme was that we have two building blocks or two components. The first component is our signing signature scheme. That signature scheme makes sure that ciphertexts on the wire are protected unless there is a trivial impersonation. Trivial impersonation means the sender state is exposed, and the attacker takes that exposed sender state in order to create a valid-looking ciphertext that is just given to the receiver. And the receiver, of course, since that is a valid-looking ciphertext, cannot know whether this comes from the actual Alice or from the attacker. So for all cases except for such a trivial impersonation, we use the signature scheme to prove that creating a valid-looking ciphertext allows us to break the strong unforgeability on the chosen ciphertext attacks of the signature scheme. So whenever the attacker creates a ciphertext and sends that to the receiver, then this will yield, or this will basically abort the receive algorithm unless either that ciphertext was created with knowledge of the real sender state due to an exposure, and then this is a trivial impersonation, Or the attacker is able to break the unforgeability guarantees of the signature scheme. And when the attacker can do so, then we can use that attacker to break that guarantee of the signature scheme. And the second building block is somewhat a composition of the key encapsulation mechanism and the guarantees of the random oracle model. So first of all, what we say is that it should be hard for the attacker, so this is the guarantee that we want to have, it should be hard for the attacker to learn any information about the keys that are established by the sender. And so what we do is we use that confidentiality guarantees to output ciphertexts on the wire. So everything that is, or whenever the sender sends something, we know that the ciphertext that the attacker sees will not learn or will not tell the attacker anything about the keys that are established between Alice and Bob, because these keys are input to the random oracle. And if the attacker is able to learn anything about the keys that are established between Alice and Bob, then we can use that attacker to reduce the security to the security guarantees of the key encapsulation mechanism. And the basic idea is that with every random oracle operation, we establish a new chem key pair between sender and receiver. And so basically, if the attacker learns anything about the inputs to the current random oracle invocation on the sender or on the receiver side, then this means, or if the attacker is able to query the random oracle on the sender or receiver side, then that means that the attacker learns the key that the key encapsulation mechanism establishes. And so we can use such an attacker that is able to query the random oracle to break the security of the key encapsulation mechanism. And now, due to that, we have the guarantee that there is no attacker that can query the random oracle on the inputs that are given from the key encapsulation mechanism. Now, the output of that random oracle is the new key pair of the key encapsulation mechanism. And so we can use this new key encapsulation mechanism key pair as a fresh key pair. The attacker does not know where that comes from because the attacker was not able to query the random oracle model, query the random oracle on that. And so basically, this is a chain of the chem gives us security guarantees. Therefore, we can argue that the random oracle cannot be queried. Therefore, the outputs of the random oracle are not known to the attacker. And therefore, we can again start with the guarantees that the key encapsulation mechanism gives us. Okay, this was maybe very high level. Let's write down the proof. So game zero is our indistinguishability game. For unidirectional ratcheted key exchange from last week. Just as a very, very quick reminder, how does that game look like? This was our security game. We have four oracles. We have a send oracle, we have a receive oracle, we have an expose oracle for sender and for receiver. The send oracle outputs the ciphertext and either the real key or the random key. The receive oracle outputs typically nothing. Where are we? Here. The receive oracle typically outputs nothing unless the receiver just jumps from receiving everything that the sender sent to the first ciphertext that the sender didn't send but was received by the receiver. Then we are in that situation here. So we jump from the sync bit set to zero to one to the sync bit set to zero. And this should be hard unless this is a trivial impersonation. And for that reason, then a challenge key is output, or if this is a trivial impersonation and things are out of sync already, then after that, the attacker always only sees the real key. Okay. There were some conditions that we identified under which we do not give the attacker further information. And so with that game in mind, we will now prove that our construction is secure. The first game that we specify is a guess. And this follows somewhat from the idea that we saw in the exercise already today. And the idea is basically, until when do we want to protect, or until when can we achieve security? And we start, and this is something that we can keep in mind, we start typically with trying to reduce the strength of the attacker from an active attacker to a passive attacker. And the primitive that helps us to do that is the signature scheme. And so first we identify until when we use or until when we need the strength, the power, the secrecy, the security guarantee from the signature scheme. And that is exactly until the step in which there is a trivial impersonation, or until at the very end of the game, if there is never the aim to forge anything. So what we first guess is an integer and forge, and we sample that integer from the set of integers Q receive plus one. And QReceive is the number of Oracle queries to Oracle Receive. And now what we do with this number, with this integer, is that if the query to Oracle receive with number and forge is not the one that flips bit sync from zero from one to zero. We abort the game. And so we see here that either one of the queries to Oracle receive flips that bit. And in that case, we try to guess it, and we are correct with probability 1 over Q receive. Or that bit never flips, and this is basically just also considered as one of the options. For that reason, we basically have this as the probability of guessing correctly. And now in the second step, we know which ciphertext will help us to reduce an attack against the unidirectional ratcheted key exchange scheme to the security guarantees that the signature scheme gives us. And this is exactly the ciphertext that is received with that nForge receive oracle query. Yeah. We can assume that we know the number of queries to each of the oracles. And the basic idea is that we have an attacker, so we are the reduction, and we take an attacker, and that attacker is the one that tries to break us. And so what we do is we let that attacker run and just observe how it behaves. And if we start with the wrong number of oracle queries, we can basically just change our behavior until we find the right number of oracle queries that we expect from the beginning. And we can basically do a binary search, so we can start with one number and we can increase our window of numbers for that oracle, or we can decrease that. We can do that for all the oracle queries. So basically, in all the proofs that we do with such types, we can assume that we know the number of oracle queries from the beginning. And the way we would do that in practice is we take a successful adversary, observe how many oracle queries it takes, and if we run into a problem because our assumption was wrong, we will just start it again and set the number higher or lower. Does that make sense? I was also, I think we can look at that offline again into deeper details, but also when I remember that when I was looking at that for the first time, I was also not very convinced by that. And maybe I will have to look at that deeper again to give you a more convincing answer, but this was the answer that I remembered since then, and I think there might be other techniques to prove that we can assume that we know the number of oracle queries. Yeah. Okay. So as I said, now we are in the comfortable situation that we know what ciphertext will flip the bit of sync from 1 to 0. And for that ciphertext, we have to use the security guarantees of our signature scheme, unless this ciphertext is a trivial impersonation, and then anyway, we don't have to prove anything here. Okay. So if in the nForge query to oracle receive, the sender was not exposed for the corresponding prior state. So that means nForge is not an element of that exposed set of states that were exposed on the sender side. And the received ciphertext was accepted. then we abort the game. So these are the conditions that tell us that the ciphertext that was received and that flipped the bit from 1 to 0 was not a trivial impersonation. Because first of all, the sender was not exposed for the state that would allow the attacker to trivial impersonate the sender. And secondly, the ciphertext was still valid. So it was a ciphertext that indeed impersonated the sender, but not trivially. Okay. So we reduced this, the ability of the attacker to detect this modification, to the strong unforgeability of unchosen message attacks for the signature scheme. And so the distinguisher here distinguishes between game 1 and game 0. Game 1 and game 2, sorry. And our reduction is also one that is able to reduce an attacker that identifies this difference to the signatures. Strong unforgeability guarantees. So this game starts with generating a signature key pair and sends the verification key to our reduction. Our reduction can, whenever it wants to, send a message to this game and obtain back a signature. And at the very end, our reduction has to come up with a message and a signature such that the following guarantees hold. So first of all, what happens here is that our reduction obtains back the real signature for the message that was just queried. And at the end, we verify that if the verification under the verification key and the message and the signature that the attacker or that our reduction believes to be a valid forgery verifies correctly, and a second condition, then we stop with 1, otherwise we stop with 0. So, a reminder, what was the security guarantees that, or what was the second condition for an attacker to win the strong unforgeability game on the chosen message attacks? Strong unforgeability is the notion in which we only forbid the attacker to win trivial attacks. So what is the only trivial attack that exists here? So we passed the message. Which message? and which oracle? Yeah.
Cannot be repaired. It was before queried and received from the
object. Yeah, exactly. So there are two notions of security for signatures. The first one is existential unforgeability, the second one is strong unforgeability. We'll explain in a second why we use strong unforgeability here. So existential unforgeability means that in both cases, of course, the forgery must be verifiable. So it must be a valid looking signature. But in existential unforgeability, it suffices that the message here was not queried before. In strong unforgeability, we require that this pair here was not queried to the signing oracle before. So this here is this signing oracle. The attacker can query messages and see real signatures. And if we just require that the message here was not queried before, then this means that no matter what signature was seen here, if the attacker comes up with a new signature, this is still not a valid attack. And the reason is that it is much easier. So existential unforgeability makes sense in cases in which existential unforgeability suffices for us. And it particularly makes sense because there are signature schemes that provide existential unforgeability and that are much more efficient than schemes that provide strong unforgeability. And strong unforgeability means that even if the attacker saw a signature for a message, it must still be hard to come up with a different signature for the same message. So the signature scheme must even protect that you cannot take one signature and slightly modify it to maintain or keep it a valid signature. While existential unforgeability, for existential unforgeability, this would not be an attack. So if you see one message and a signature and you slightly modify the signature and that still stays a valid signature, then this is not an attack against existential unforgeability. The reason why we need strong unforgeability here is that the conditions under which the sync bit flips from 1 to 0 is determined by the full transcript, by the full ciphertext that the receiver sees. And the signature is part of that transcript. And so if the attacker is just able to flip a single bit or change a single bit in the signature, then this changes the entire ciphertext and this flips the sync bit from 1 to 0. But if this is not an attack that we can reduce to the assumptions that we use, and the assumption here is the strong unforgeability, or is the security guarantees of the signature, if we cannot use this to attack the signature scheme, then we are in a situation in which we have an attack that we cannot reduce. And so our proof is not sound. So we have to use a guarantee for the signature scheme that helps us to really prove that all attacks against the transcript are caught by the underlying signature scheme. Okay, so whenever a signing query is made, then we keep track of the message signature pairs. And at the very end of that game, we just check that the message signature pair was not queried before. Okay, so what do we need to, or when do we need to use the information that we just produce here? under which conditions do we need to do anything? Under which conditions do we need to simulate anything to the distinguisher? There are three cases in which the attacker learns anything about the modification that we implement here. Or three oracles that we have to slightly change. First of all, the send oracle. So in the nForsh query to the send oracle, we know that the signing key pair is distributed between sender and receiver, because the receiver with that state will receive the ciphertext that will drive sender and receiver out of sync, which means that before that, sender and receiver were in sync. And so when the sender sends something, the sender has to send something signed by that signature key pair. And we don't want to use that signature key pair anymore. And for that reason, in the nForsh query to that oracle, we will ask the signing oracle for that signature. That's the only time that we need that signature oracle. Since we update our signing key pair with every send operation and every receive operation, we will just use one signature from that signature key pair that protects, or that we use to protect against that type of attack. Interestingly, in the game, so we can take a look at that. In the game here, it can happen that that bit here flips from 1 to 0, and this is independent of whether the receiver was exposed before or not. So the key that is computed here, and that is output as a challenge key, that key can be given to the attacker with the only limitation that the sender was not exposed. So this R here, which is nForge in our proof, must not be an element in set XS. And XS is only filled based on the exposure of the sender. That means that the exposure oracle of the receiver can be queried even before the receive operation happened here. So we have to simulate that oracle, and we have to simulate that consistently. And so if the exposure of the receiver happens before the, or after the nForge minus one query to the receive oracle, then we have to embed the verification key. So after the nForge minus one query to receive, embed verification key in state of the receiver. And finally, let's look at our construction again. So our full construction in the ciphertext contains the verification key of the next operation. And so we have to embed that verification key in the previous send operation already to be let it be transmitted from sender to receiver. Everything else is simulated honestly. So the final operation, the final observation that we make is that D can only distinguish between game 1 and 2 if game 2 aborts. And this only happens upon successful signature forgery. And for that reason, the advantage of an attacker in game 1 smaller or equal the advantage in game 2 plus the advantage of an attacker against the signature scheme in the SUF CMA game against an attacker B that attacks that signature scheme. Okay, any questions so far? Game three will just help us a little bit to specify our hybrid argument that we will just start in a bit. And that game three will identify again the situation in which we, under certain conditions, cannot hope for security based on the other primitive that we use, which is the key encapsulation mechanism. And so what we do here is we guess an integer n expose from the set of integers up to q receive, where q receive is the number of oracle queries to oracle receive. And now the behavior of the game is changed as follows. If the receiver state is not exposed for the first time, after the nexpose query to the receive oracle, we abort the game. So we will now have a hybrid argument. With n send steps. Where we define n send as follows. Either it is q send, and this is the case when n expose is larger than n forge, or it is n expose otherwise. So the two cases are as follows. The first case is that the exposure on the receiver side happens after the receiver receives something that drives the receiver out of sync. So that flips the bit from 1 to 0. And the only option that this can still happen is that there happens a trivial impersonation of the sender. A non-trivial impersonation is not possible anymore due to due to game two. But once that happens, so once the receiver state is out of sync, it is perfectly fine that the receiver is exposed afterwards, because we will see, or we will have to prove, that the receiver key material is independent of what happens on the sender side, and so the sender keys must still be secure. And for that reason, if the receiver is exposed after the receiver is out of sync, then we have to prove security for all keys established by the sender from the first key until the last key. The second option is that the exposure happens before the receiver gets out of sync. So if the receiver is exposed before the receiver gets out of sync, then all of the keys computed by the, or computed in sync by sender and receiver will not be required to be secure anymore. Because, of course, the receiver is deterministic. When the receiver is still in sync, then everything that is computed by the receiver, once the receiver is exposed, can be computed by the attacker as well. And so also all the keys that are computed by the sender will be computable by the attacker. And so in that second case, the exposure happens while sender and receiver are still out of sync. We only have to prove security for all keys established until the situation in which the sender computes a key that is still computable by the, or that is computable by the receiver, and after this the exposure of the receiver happens, and then after that all the keys computed by sender and receiver do not offer any guarantees anymore, and so we have to we don't have to prove anything. Okay, so both of these cases, so n expose is definitely smaller than q send here. And so basically, this is an argument of at most q send steps. Where qsend is the number of queries to the send oracle. And now, in step I of and send, we do the following steps. The first step is not changing anything from the perspective of the attacker. The first step is only changing things from the reduction's perspective. The basic, or the wording for this is, so this is game. Four. The wording for this is lazy. Sampling. Lazy sampling means that we compute outputs of, in this case, the random oracle, only when the attacker learns about these outputs. So basically, we only when something is given to the wire, so some output is given from the send oracle, or when the attacker exposes the sender or receiver, and outputs of or parts of the sender state or parts of the receiver state are outputs of the random oracle, then we tell the random oracle, okay, this is going to be an output here. You have to, or we keep track of that this is an output of a random oracle query that was performed inside the following send operation or the following receive operation. Just a quick reminder, so we talked about the random oracle last week. This is the idea of the random oracle model. We have an attacker the attacker is not able to call the hash function locally, but instead there is an oracle that the attacker can query to obtain the outputs to the hash function. And in principle, we as the challenger or reduction could do the same, but from the attacker's perspective, there is no way to see whether we just call that oracle or whether we simulate that oracle. The basic or the most primitive simulation of the random oracle is that the attack or that the random oracle for each input samples the output and then stores that this was the output for that input and just returns that output. What we can always do is, as long as the attacker never specified the input, we can just specify the output already and wait for the situation in which the attacker is querying for the outputs. Sounds a bit strange, but it works. So as long as the attacker has never queried the random oracle, but we know what the output to a particular input will be, we can specify that output, but we don't need to know the input yet. And vice versa, as long as the attacker never queried the random oracle here, we can just specify the outputs that are relevant for us, but for all the others, we don't have to specify them yet. This is the idea of lazy sampling. And this is what we are going to do in this next step. So it's basically just, changing the way we program our reduction, but not really changing anything from the perspective of the attacker. Okay, so we lazy sample the output of the random oracle model, of the random oracle output of the random oracle in the ith query. And in particular, that means only compute the outputs when the adversary queries for the corresponding inputs externally. So the advantage of game 3 is exactly the advantage of game 4. There was no change. The only change that we did was the way that we program the random oracle. And just as a quick reminder or clarification, this is the random oracle, and we can just do with the random oracle whatever we want to. We are the reduction, we program the random oracle, and we don't have to put any outputs into the random oracle as long as the attacker did not see or does not want to see these outputs and so did not query for the corresponding inputs. Only as soon as the attacker queries for these inputs, we have to specify these the corresponding outputs. Okay. Now the next step is using the strength of the key encapsulation mechanism. And for this, we detect that the attacker is able to compute something for which we believe that it should be hard to compute it by observing the queries of the attacker to the random oracle. So what we do now is we abort if the adversary queries the random oracle for the inputs specified by the ith query to Oracle send. So our reduction is to the chem's security, and we will see, in contrast to what we've seen today in the exercise, that one way CCA security suffices. And the reason is that we now use this random oracle for which we can extract the distinguishability properties to a one-way type of solution. We will see in a second how that works. And so just as a reminder, how does the security game one-way CCA security works? First of all, internally, a key pair is generated and the encapsulation key for the chem is given to the attacker. Additionally, the adversary is able to query for ciphertexts. Let's do that the other way around. So the attacker is able to query for ciphertexts and obtain back the keys. And the game specifies the following challenge. It just queries, or it internally executes the encapsulation algorithm, obtains from that the challenge ciphertext and the challenge key. And at the very end, the adversary has to specify a solution, K star, and the attacker basically wins if K prime equals K star. Stop with one, otherwise stop with zero. So this is this type of security guarantee that we can have, and the only exception for a response to the decapsulation oracle here is that if C does not equal C star, then the game responds to that query. Okay, so this is the assumption that we can use. Now we have to use that assumption to build a reduction to prove that it is hard to distinguish between step I minus 1 and step I in our hybrid argument. So first of all, we have to embed the encapsulation key. So the encapsulation key is visible at the following Oracle query, exposure of the sender. So after the I minus 1th query to send, embed the encapsulation key in the sender state. Now for the send oracle, in the ith query, embed C star as the chem ciphertext. And now if the game aborts, use the random oracle inputs as solution k prime. And now there is an observation. So this does not work entirely yet. There is a case for which our reduction is not smart enough to how to handle it. For that reason, we have to slightly adapt our assumption or our security game of one-way CCA security. And this is a little bit, so our specification of our reduction and of our games is high level. We do not specify it in the details as we would when we would write a proof in a research paper. And so what we do here is we basically say, if the attacker queries the send oracle's internal inputs to the random oracle in the ith query to, or for the ith query of the send oracle, then we abort the game. And then we try to extract from the random oracle inputs our solution to our chem challenger. So we basically say, there is the ith query to the send oracle, then there is the query to the random oracle, and we say if the inputs to the random oracle equal the ones that are queried inside the send oracle, then we use these inputs as a solution to our own challenger. The problem here is we say that the inputs here help us to solve something. So in principle, we don't know these inputs yet. In particular, we don't know the chem key input. Because if we knew the chem key input, we couldn't use it as a challenge. Or put differently, the challenge does not tell us what the inputs to the random oracle are. The challenge from the chem just tells us this is the challenge ciphertext, use it, embed it somewhere, and tell me what the key to that ciphertext is. In the ith send oracle query, we then have to simulate things. We have to simulate the output of the random oracle. Many things. The only thing that we don't know is the chem key to the chem ciphertext. And now we say once the random oracle is queried with that chem key, and when with the other inputs, then we abort the game, take the key, and extract from that the solution to our chem game. So this sounds a little bit like a circular argument. So we simulate the send oracle. We don't know the inputs to the random oracle. In particular, we don't know the chem key for the chem ciphertext. But then we say we abort if the random oracle is queried on that particular input. We don't know that input. We just get a query from the attacker to the random oracle, and the attacker could just send arbitrary chem keys as input to the random oracle. The attacker could just give us, or the attacker can query the random oracle multiple times with the same. So let's look at the construction. What are the inputs to the random oracle here? So this is the construction, and the inputs to the random oracle that we know are the transcript and the ciphertext. The ciphertext consists of the verification key simulated by ourselves, the signature simulated by ourselves, the ciphertext, and this is the ciphertext that we just get from our challenger. So we know that ciphertext, we just embedded it here into the full ciphertext. We know the entire ciphertext, we know the transcript from the last random oracle output. The only thing that we don't know is this key here. And now we say once the adversary externally queries the random oracle on these three inputs, then we take this input here to solve our chem challenge. The attacker can try to play with us by querying the random oracle with this T and this ciphertext and just some arbitrary bit string. This is not a solution. This is not a valid solution for our chem game. And so we have to have some form of capability, some form of skill that allows us to check whether this is the key that works for this chem challenge ciphertext. Does that make sense? So I basically said now, we lazy sampled the random oracle in the ith query to the send oracle. So inside of that execution of the send algorithm, we don't know the inputs to the send to the random oracle, but we abort if the random oracle is queried on the inputs that are queried to the send oracle, inside the send oracle. So we don't know these inputs, but we have to verify them. And for that reason, instead of giving just one final solution as a key here, what we do is, or what we allow ourselves to do, is that we have some kind of a checking oracle. So we slightly change this here. So if the attacker against the one-way CCA security game comes up with the real key, so then we stop with key star equals k prime, but if the given key is not the challenge key, then we set no to 1 and we respond with no. And so the basic idea is we now have some kind of a checking oracle. So we can check if the key here equals the challenge key. If our guess was correct, then we win the game. Otherwise, we can ask the same oracle again. So is this the real key? And at some point, we might be able to find the real key, and so we win that game. And indeed, the attacker will only... So the distinguisher here, the distinguisher on the right side, the distinguisher on the right side will only see the difference between game I minus 1 and I if it is successful in querying the random oracle on the right inputs. But that means that for that query, the attacker comes up with the right key for our challenge here. And due to that, the attacker will be able to trigger that we win the one-way CCA security game. And so our final modification of the game here is that for the random oracle on input X, if T and C for X equals T K prime comma C, match with the ith internal values for the random oracle query in the ith send query ask k prime to the challenger. So while you can maybe look at that, I will just write down final trivial things because that almost ends our proof. So basically, we will see that the advantage in game 4 is less equal the advantage in game 5 plus the advantage of one way one CCA security for the chem. For an attacker against that chem. Maybe for more clarity, I will add one more argument here. The one situation where we need CCA security is that the receive oracle is queried for a trivial impersonation. So the sender is exposed, the attacker uses the exposed sender state to send a ciphertext to the receiver, and the receiver receives a ciphertext that was not sent by the original sender. In that case, we wouldn't know how to simulate the computation of the receiver unless we have access to a decapsulation oracle for the key encapsulation mechanism. And this is what we use exactly here. So if the receiver receives a ciphertext, if C was a trivial in the ICE, so if C was a trivial impersonation in the ICE query, then we use the challenger's oracle decrypt for that ciphertext. Okay, and then finally, after this step in the nth step or in the nth hybrid step, so let's call it that way, after this game in the nth hybrid step, all challenge keys are random oracle outputs for which the adversary never queried the random oracle on the corresponding inputs. And that means basically that the advantage in game 5 equals 0. Because basically all the real keys are now outputs of the random oracle, and the random oracle outputs things that are randomly sampled. And so the randomly sampled outputs from the random oracle, for which the attacker never saw the outputs because it never queried the inputs, just look the same as the challenge keys that are also just uniformly randomly sampled. And so in total, we have that the advantage against our scheme under the IND definition from last week for an attacker is less or equal Q receive plus 1 times the advantage against the signature scheme's strong unforgeability security plus Q receive times Q send times the advantage of the one way 1 times CCA security of the chem for an attacker against that chem. Okay. Are there any questions left? Otherwise, we can talk about that next week. Then I would like to thank you for your attention, and I see you next week.